Welcome to the YPO-WPO GCC Field Reflections, Them Not Us, September 8th, 2015 conference call. My name is Lorraine, and I will be your operator for today's call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. Please note that this conference is being recorded. We now turn the call over to Mr. Rassel Hamwi from YPO Lavent. Mr. Hamwi, you may begin.
Thank you. William James once said about humanity, "We are like islands in the sea, separate on the surface, but connected in the deep." My name is Basil Hamwi, and I'm very pleased to be introducing today an individual who is connecting with people who are as diverse as these islands. In doing so, I believe that not only is he helping save lives, but also make an impact well beyond that on their communities, as well as on himself. Dr. Javed Abdelmunaim is a physician with Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders. Javed became involved with MSF in his second year of university as a medical student, working with Access Campaign to promote the accessibility of medicines for neglected diseases. Since then, Javed has responded to the most acute humanitarian crises of our time, including missions in Iraq, Haiti, South Sudan, Lebanon for Syria, and most recently responding to the Ebola crisis in Sierra Leone. Not only is Javed an experienced MSF doctor, he's also an MSF UK board member and medical presenter for Al Jazeera's The Cure, an award-winning series exploring innovations in health and medicine. We are really delighted that you have joined us for this global conference call in conversations with Javed, as he shares his insights, stories, and reflections as a frontline field worker for MSF. 2 days ago, I've had the pleasure of meeting Javed and seeing his work up front here in Dubai. I felt really touched that we have such amazing people going around the world, risking their lives to make sure that hope does not die. I'd like to turn it over now to Javed, who will speak for about 30 minutes, and then we'll take another 15 to 20 minutes of questions and answers. This call is being recorded. An archived link will be posted on the Thriving Communities, Peace Action, and Global Diplomacy and Public Policy Network page on the Exchange. Also available as a podcast 1 hour after the call. Javed, my friend, take it away.
Thank you very much, Basil. What a kind introduction. Very nice to speak to you again. And thank you, everybody, for dialing in on behalf of MSF. I wish to thank you for joining us. As you've heard, my name is Dr. Javed Abdelmunaim, and I'm very happy to actually be here in Dubai, in UAE, calling from the regional MSF office. I'm very grateful for this opportunity to show off a little about what MSF does and also to give you my personal experiences of our work around the world, which is itself an exercise in témoignage, and this is something like what MSF, it's part of our ethos. But firstly, to tell you a little bit more about who I am, I was born and raised in the UK. I went to university in London and became a doctor in 2003. I first applied to MSF in 2006, was rejected, and not being someone to give up too easily, I reapplied 3 years later and was very happy to be given my first mission in Iraq. And went straight after that to Haiti, spending in total 1 year abroad at that time. Also, of course, you've heard that I am now an MSF UK board member, which means I'm very much involved in the governance of the charity and a trustee. And I see there are some of you here from New York and Dubai, London and Bahrain and Canada, so welcome everybody, Lebanon even. So as MSF, you wonder, I don't know how much you know about who we are and why we even have a French name, Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, at Tibat Bila Hudud. We're over 40 years old now, and we're a medical humanitarian organization that is independent. So we actually receive just about 90% of our funding from the ordinary public, the remainder coming from corporate donations. And our staff is actually 90% national staff. So where I was working in Sierra Leone, where I've been working in Iraq, Haiti, and elsewhere, 90% of our staff are actually local staff. And someone like me coming from abroad just represents just 10% of the staff, in total about 30,000 people. But not just doctors, nurses, psychotherapists, physiotherapists, logisticians, admin, engineers, water and sanitation, many, many different types of staff. You may have actually seen that we were responding to the Ebola epidemic, probably the largest sort of exposure we've had internationally most recently, and also after Haiti. So two contexts there being natural disasters and epidemics. But we also, of course, intervene when there's exclusion from healthcare and conflict situations, which sadly, as you know, from around the world now seems to be about two-thirds of our work, our interventions are in conflict and post-conflict zones, primarily in the Middle East region, also in South Sudan, Central African Republic, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Altogether in about 70 countries around the world, even in Eastern Europe, in Southern Europe. So we're everywhere, and I'd presume you've all, or assume perhaps you all may have come across us in one capacity or another. As I mentioned earlier, témoignage is something that's really a core principle in our ethos. We guard our independence, our neutrality, and our impartiality. As doctors, it doesn't matter to us who the patient is on the bed, where they come from, what they've done, how they got their injury or their disease. It's a basic medical ethic. But also témoignage, to bring back to other countries or bring back to the wider world a knowledge of the context, the issues that have caused these sort of unstable environments. So it means to bear witness. It comes from the French verb témoigner. We were first... came about by two or three French doctors in Paris in 1971, hence our French background. And so even this itself is an exercise in témoignage for me to be able to tell you, and you so graciously listening for the next 3 minutes, about my stories, about where I've been, the context in which MSF has worked, and why we needed to be there. It's bringing you knowledge as to why this has happened. And you know, in the best circumstance, I could imagine you might go away, tell others, and word spreads about why there is exclusion from healthcare, why there is inequality in healthcare, and why we have to be in these contexts. I hope to be able to give you a little insight into my last 18 months with MSF. I was twice in the field as a doctor myself in Sierra Leone and in South Sudan. And also I visited our project in Amman, which is a unique project in MSF and very special, which I'll come to at the end. So actually in Easter of last year, we're talking March and April of 2014, I was very happy to receive a phone call from head office saying we need a doctor in the flying team in South Sudan. And I love flying. I love being in aeroplanes. So this was for me a very exciting mission. Being half Sudanese, I was very glad to be able to go to South Sudan finally. Flew into Juba, and the context there very much was in a conflict and post-conflict situation. And this is one of the themes that I will touch upon, and one of the things that make me very frustrated, very angered, so to speak, and motivated to wish to change the world, so to speak, is that my personal belief here, and also the interpretation of the context, is that this conflict in South Sudan, a new nation in 2011 with all the hopes of a blank slate, this conflict, which became an ethnic conflict between the two major clans, the Nuer and the Dinka, was brought about simply by the president and the vice president, each of their respective ethnicity, having political struggles, a struggle for power. Two men, human beings, entrusted with the fate of a nation, coming to blows, metaphorically, obviously, over politics and power, and then turning it into an ethnic conflict and breaking down into a civil war, now with millions displaced and illness throughout the country and a need for us to be there. South Sudan, consistently our greatest area of intervention by money, by logistics, and by number of projects and consultations and patients treated, consistently for the last few years and maybe into the last decade, always our highest area of need. And it's just so sad that it is man-made. This is a man-made context, and it's one of my, you know, I could shout from the rooftops, you know, I feel so strongly that these two men have spoilt that country. In any way, so I flew in, and our mission was to provide medical care to a tribe there called the Murle, and this tribe, from the very inception of the nation, had not been given national ID cards to deliberately exclude them from any structure of government. and to not give them healthcare, vaccinations, access to free education or otherwise, access to food deliveries, access to employment in the city. You cannot get a job if you're not a national ID card holder. So this tribe have been forcibly excluded from society by the powers that be, and MSF finds a need to be there. But South Sudan is so remote, particularly in the rainy season, and so vast that you have to get around by helicopters. And that really, on a very childish personal level, that really, really was exciting, you know. But also you have to imagine when you're traveling with a helicopter or an aircraft that can take only 1,000 kilos, and you want to fly to a region 2 hours away, and you need to stay there for 5 days, which is our plan usually, 4 or 5 days, to run a mobile clinic to treat, come what may, for whatever illness that you find, live, eat, and sleep, and treat, and come back for 5 days, you need some logistics. And it's pretty fantastic. It was the first time I was exposed to that level of dynamic sort of statistics, logistics, because, you know, it was really quite intricate having to plan how many malaria treatments to take based on how many patients we might see that are under the age of 5, and to fit that in with the 1,000-kilo weight load, which included us. So I was lucky that I'm short. I don't weigh that much. I'm only 60 kilos. Hey, so I think I saved 20 kilos but compared to the next doctor, which meant we could take more medicines. We could take more water to drink. We would take our tents. We would live. We would cook on a fire. And you might think, well, how did the patients know that we're coming? Actually, we would use the same geographical location. We would choose 4 locations in the northeast, southwest extremes of this region, Jonglei. And we would have our contacts. So despite remoteness, there is always a mobile phone network. And we will be able to call the local elders and say, we're coming on such and such day. Tell everybody to come along. And it was impactful. I think I will always remember 2 or 3 patients. Once, actually, it was probably on my third clinic in one of the eastern areas. A little girl walked in, just about managing to walk with her parents, and she looked like a ghost, could I say. She looked like she was emaciated. She had no life in her eyes. She, you know, if a child, as a doctor, if a child lets you manhandle them to examine without giving up any ounce of a fight, without a scream, without a cry, without looking to their parents, that's a bad sign. They have no energy to even be afraid of this strange white person, or I'm brown, but you know, this strange person examining them. This is an unwell child. She looked awful. And I think back and I thought to myself, my God, my first thought was she must have HIV, end-stage HIV. I don't have the capability in a mobile clinic to do that. It's called a mobile clinic, but you take a pen, paper, and some tablets. We have no investigations. It's all clinical. And I looked at the parents, and they didn't look unwell, so I thought it can't be that, because she would have only had it as a mother-to-child transmission. And then I thought back to my time in Haiti, where I was treating a lot of typhoid. We, thankfully, in that project, had the test for typhoid. And this girl looked like that. She just looked like I don't want to say it, but a walking dead. It wasn't acute malnutrition. It wasn't that. And so I thought I'd treat her blindly. Thankfully, I'd take a range of antibiotics in case I come across chest infections, diarrheal infections. So I take a range of antibiotics on these mobile clinics. And I had the right treatment, and we were there for 5 days. They actually walked in on the first day. And I was able to blindly, we say, without a test, treat her for typhoid. And I asked the parents to bring her back over the next, on the second, third, and fourth day. And what was amazing was by the third day, not the next day, but by the third day, she actually just started to be inquisitive with her environment. She looked at me, and you could almost see life in her eyes. And her father had said that she'd asked for food for the first time in a while. And so I gave her some of the plumpy nut that we had. And by the fourth day, she was, you know, almost a lively child. And I think back, and I think back to her, and I think she would have died. You know, this region is an 8-hour walk in one direction to the nearest town that has a market. And in that market, there are medicines, but no medics. And those medicines would not be safe. They could be entirely fake. They could be poisonous. What does a parent know what to buy for their child in that area of the world? Even if they had the money, even if they walked 8 hours there and 8 hours back, would that medicine be working, and would it be the correct medicine? And for me, that child more than anything, sort of embodies exactly what we were there for. You know, she would be dead. There is no way to say that she would have survived. And I think she had a case of typhoid. And I'm secretly, you know, I'm pleased with myself for us having been there and being able to do that. I really am. But it was a very interesting context. You know, I was walking when we were flying with the helicopter. It's just so remote, and I could see an old, or at least a burnt out army base from the window. And we were shockingly received on one occasion by two young soldiers. There are child soldiers everywhere. They're such a tall race. They're like 6 foot, 6 foot five, but they're only 14. They're only 13, 10, dwarfing me, towering over me. And I was escorted by these two soldiers. I speak Arabic. They spoke Arabic, thank goodness. I was escorted by these soldiers to go and see one of their comrades. It was about a 3-kilometer walk. And we walked through this bombed-out base, and there was a pile, I'll never forget, a pile of dead bodies burnt out. And you could see their legs. There were at least three or four different pairs of legs still sticking out. And I stopped and I looked at that, and, you know, and the first thing that I thought to myself was, like, maybe if I'm telling you now and you just think these are bodies and it's so easy for that to pass over you. But I could see some skin on one of the feet, and it just looked like a man was lying there if I didn't look further up the leg. And it really brought home, you know, these are people. This is someone's brother. This would have been a soldier or not. But if someone's brother, someone's son, it affected me in such a way as to really bring home, you know, whenever we hear numbers of, you know, numbers of dead, numbers of people, numbers of consultations, even, you just think whatever. But it's a person. This was a son to some woman somewhere, and she's mourning him. She's never had his body back. What a horrible death this man had. Burnt on a pile, left, not even buried, probably eaten by the local wildlife. Dreadful situation. And I ended up arriving at this village, and out came this soldier hobbling on his foot, and it had been blown off by a mine 4 months previously, and it was infected, and he was walking on the raw bone. And you think to yourself, my God, fantastic, he's not had sepsis and died. B, he was young. He had to then spend the rest of his life in what is a society where you need to move and work and do hard labor and farm and or fight. What would he do for the rest of his life being a burden to his family? You can imagine the thoughts going through his mind. Luckily, in Juba, in the capital city, we were working inside a UN camp to provide medical care to the internally displaced peoples. And we had a system where we could evacuate anybody that I found like this back to Juba, fly him back to get his surgical treatment, and then fly him home again. So I was very pleased to be able to arrange for that. But I never know exactly his outcome, because that was on my last clinic. But for me, a really interesting mission, one where we are very close to the context, very close to the people there, and very reactive at being able to move around and change and do and get what we can. So I very much enjoyed that. And I spent 4.5 weeks there, and I came back to England just at the end of Easter. And summer passed, and by then Ebola had hit the headlines. It was out of control, even by MSF standards. I can tell you guys, you know, I'm used to MSF handling everything that's thrown at us, even internally. But I got an email, and it said, it actually said in no more words than I'm about to say, we're desperate. We're utterly desperate for hands-on. We're losing this battle. If you're free, can you come? And that, you know, that was shocking, frankly, for me to receive. I've never seen something like that in MSF in all my years. So I went, but I was scared, and you can imagine. And I got there in mid-September, and if you recall, it was September the 15th or 16th, any of you, that our president was, Joanne Liu, was briefing the Security Council about what the needs were and asking for help, and asking for the military help. For MSF, this is just unheard of, to say that we need military help, no less. And so it sent a shiver down my spine, and I was stuck in Casablanca. And that's another thing that I think about for this epidemic. And you know, the reaction of the West, or the reaction of the world, was to close off West Africa, was to stop all commercial flights apart from two airlines. And I had to take Royal Air Maroc, and I lost 4 days of my mission sitting in Casablanca with lost luggage waiting for a connection, all flights full, impossible even to get there, even to give the care that we wanted to. And when I got there, it was, it was as hard as you might imagine. I was well prepared to see a lot of death. I had been in Haiti for the cholera epidemic, so I had shored up my sort of psychological resilience. But I got touched. I got touched by two patients, and I got scarred by one of them, and I got scarred by a lot of deaths that I saw that were just so sudden. You can't imagine, as you're listening on the phone now, some, you know, young or old dying so suddenly that they would die exactly where they were. One man, I went in, I would dress up in all my PPE, those layers of clothing that take a long time to put on. I went in to transfer him. He had been diagnosed positive from the triage, so we would have to move them through to the confirmed area of the hospital. And I arrived and got into the tent, and he was sitting in a position where he had literally just unsupported on the edge of his bed, had slumped forward and had died at the age of 19, just like that, sitting there fully dressed. He was still holding a bar of soap. And I saw him just as I went into the tent, and it was so shocking, it arrested me right there standing. And you just think, what on earth happened to this young man to have died so suddenly that he just slumped forward? Who knows? We know nothing about the disease. We had no treatment. I had gone there promising myself I was going there to give morphine at the last minute of someone's death so they don't have pain when they die, and to hold their hand. You don't want to die alone in pain, watching the next person having died next to you on your bed. It was drastic. And once that guy was 19, that day I had a 20-year-old. His name was Mohammed. He died calling out his father's name, who was in the next tent. He was on the floor. We couldn't even get him off the floor onto his bed. It felt awful. And it came to a climax where this little boy I'd been following, his parents had already died. He was 1 year old. He died a death that was one that I would not wish on anyone, although I tell myself I got morphine in there. That is what MSF was here to do. We did it. I got him morphine. But I went, I grieved. I knew he hurt. His death hurt me, and I knew I wanted to go to his grave to mourn. And I went. I went 2 days later when we were burying him. We had set up the organization so the burials were happening by the Red Cross. Surveillance was supposed to happen by the WHO, and management centers by us, the MSF. I went to the grave, and I found, to my horror, this was about 3 weeks in, that all the people I had known who had died, and I assumed they were going to a grave, they were being buried at least in single graves, but in unmarked graves, just mounds in a clearing in the forest, about 200 meters down from our center. And when I saw the little boy Alpha go into his grave, it was a raw feeling to be unmourned, to be in an unmarked grave, to have died an orphan. He looked frightened near his end. He looked frightened. He was 1 year old, and he looked into my eyes, and I swear he said, "Please let me die now." And I thought to myself, this would not happen. This would not happen where any of you are listening from today. This would not happen. And it really, really struck me. It was, you know, there, right there, was a product of a total indifference that I call, and I've said this before and I'll say it 100 times. You know, there have been 10, 15 Ebola outbreaks over 40 years. Do any of you believe that if they were happening where you're listening today, that there wouldn't have been a treatment a year ago? Do any of you believe that? Of course there would have been if there were Americans dying, or if there were Europeans dying this way for 40 years. We would have had a treatment by now. Why do we let this happen as a globe? Why do we let this happen as a world? I don't know. The thing that I carry away from all my MSF missions is this total, that there seems to be a total inequality in the value of a life. And I will be so blunt as to say it's almost it's where you live, and it almost not skin color, because that just happens to be where you live, but you know, an African's life is worth less than a Middle Eastern's life, who is worth less than a developed world's life. It's how I see it. Why do we hear 76 bombed in Baghdad last month doesn't even hit the news? It's numbers anymore, but they're people. They're all people who had hopes and dreams, and it really hurts me, if I could even say. So, you know, I came away from that mission, I have to admit, angry and bitter that such a thing could have happened and the world could have taken so long to react. Anyway, I got home and I did some crying and I did some thinking and reflecting, and decided to become an MSF board member and see what I could do to try and galvanize the whole world against what seemed to be a horrible tide of indifference, you know, total indifference. In any case, I was really lucky this 2 months ago to come to Amman to visit a project which I actually first visited when I was in Iraq. All of our missions or projects in Iraq, in Syria, in Gaza, in Yemen, in Egypt, when there was a lot of unrest there, we were trained and we were told that if we found patients with disfiguring facial or body injuries, that we could send them to this project. So I visited this project and I sent patients from Basra to this project in Amman for treatment. A really, really cool project where there is, we do really complex reconstructive surgery. Even as an A&E doctor and an ER doctor in the UK, I had never seen this type of surgery simply because it's not my specialty. So it was a real sort of good chance, a real chance for me to visit. And it was fantastic to see what you can do with the resources and the will. I met one man called Mohammed whose jaw was blown off by a bomb in Homs in Syria. He had been stabilized in a field hospital. His life had been saved miraculously, but without a lower jaw, how does one eat? Imagine. So he couldn't get that. The health state in Syria, of course, cannot manage that now, and it would not have been free of charge anyway. How would he have the resources to pay for that? And he'd heard, I should get to Jordan and get to this hospital. God only knows how he knew that we were there. We've actually been there since 2006. It was open for Iraq, and here we are still for Syria, the way of the world. And he's since had 8 or 9 operations, and I was really fortunate to witness a reconstruction of his jawline, bone taken from his pelvis, put into his jaw along metal plates, so that one day we can refashion teeth for him so he can eat and close his mouth and speak properly. And it was incredible, really complex work performed by surgeons who are Arabs themselves. Dr. Ashraf himself is a Jordanian-Palestinian. And it was so impressive to see that even as MSF, I'm used to thinking of mass measles vaccinations or cholera treatments or sort of low-tech, wide-spreading interventions. And here we have very high-tech, huge impact for one patient. It was really impressive to see that impact. But actually, it opens up a debate within MSF. You know, we think, gosh, how should we spread our resources? And even I'll ask any of you guys to think that. How do you, you know, should we, with our resources, try to impact 1 million people with a potentially small benefit, or impact that one man, help him to eat again? What a huge benefit that is for him. What's the debate there? Who knows? There is always, and I can tell you there is always that debate within MSF, and there's always going to be voices saying, no, we should try and get as many people as possible. But thankfully, I think for this project, we've just signed a new 7-year agreement, and I'm very happy that it's going, because I'm definitely of the opinion that if we can do it all, why shouldn't we? You know, every single last person is worth it. I've treated patients on 4 continents, and a broken arm, a worried parent, a sick child is the same in front of my eyes. But unfortunately, the world doesn't afford them, a lot of people, what we are lucky enough to have. And I'm very happy to have that perspective in life. I'm very happy to be able to find my channel to try and redress it, even one patient at a time, even if I think there are multitudes of people. I'm very happy that I have my way of doing it. I'm very, very pleased to be able to do that through MSF, to be honest. And that sort of begs the question, you are going to ask, yes, how can we help, I suppose? I don't know. We'll see. Anyway, I think that was probably over 30 minutes, was it? About 30 minutes. I hope I stuck to time there, Basil. So I'll probably draw it to a close there, and thank you all for listening and for participating in what is an exercise in témoignage. And I will leave it for Basil for you to help me with the Q&A session.
Thank you very much, Javed. This has been a very, very moving recount, especially of some of the events that you went through. The thing that comes to my mind, really, from how has this changed your perspective on human suffering, and what do you think is needed to alleviate human suffering? You have diagnosed a problem that is very clear, but what do we do about it?
It's so very difficult. I think that the first step in what to do about this is for everybody to educate themselves. I think shift your perspective from my life, my way, what am I doing, how am I going to get through today, and try and just, how can I put it? It's a hashtag first world problem type of thing. You know, a lot of people, or I get that way sometimes. If the bus is 2 minutes late, if that email hasn't arrived, if my phone charger doesn't reach the bed, get aggravated. Come on, guys, there's a lot more going on in the world. Look outwards. It will firstly give you a sense of contentment about where you are and what space in which you live. And secondly, once you start looking out, it might then drive you or give you the will, or at least engage with your compassionate side to give you the will to find a way to give back or to redress the balance, whichever way you find. But I think to start with, educate yourselves, look outwards. Go, you know, seek information. You know, if you hear the migrant crisis now of Europe, we should call it refugee/migrant crisis. You know, if you're interested in that, go and find information. Where are these people coming from? Why are they coming? What's the political scene in why they're being pushed out of their countries? What is going on? What impact could I have on that scene? Who are my contacts? Who can I network with? For example, it's just all about information and looking outward as far as I'm concerned. If that's an answer.
I think that's a very good answer. I'd like to ask the operator to open the lines for questions that are coming in verbally. There are also some questions from the web. So cool. Please go ahead.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you have a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone phone. If you wish to be removed from the queue, please press the pound sign or the hash key. There will be a delay before the first question is announced. If you are using a speakerphone, you may need to pick up the handset first before pressing the numbers. Once again, if you have a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone phone. For those listening via the webcast, you can submit questions by typing in your question. And our first question comes from Nazwa Ayu. Please go ahead.
Hi, we have a question from the web. It's from WPO. Thank you for what you were doing for so many people. I spent time in Haiti for the earthquake.
I can't hear very well at all. I'm sorry, I'll interrupt you just so that you can start again, please.
Yep, absolutely. Is this better?
Much better, thank you.
No problem. So thank you for what you are doing for so many people. I've spent time in Haiti after the earthquake and noticed that the smaller NGOs were much better at collaboration and were more effective than the larger organizations such as the Red Cross. Any comments?
I think that's a very interesting observation to have made, and congratulations in being in Haiti at that time. Yes, I think this is why we guard our independence, essentially. We are very, very happy and proud of the fact that because we receive money from Joe Public, therefore we have no strings attached, no commitments, and we can act independently. So we can be very reactive and be quick and go where we're needed without waiting for go-ahead, without waiting for coordination, without waiting for instruction, without waiting for whatever else is needed. So yes, and so we value that and believe in that and guard that independence entirely very, very strongly, because we want to be able to go where it's needed as quickly as possible. So yes, I agree, and we find we did try to engage in what was a nascent sort of way of looking at coordinating humanitarian work after Haiti, where there were so many thousands of NGOs in Haiti after that earthquake, and the UN tried to bring around a cluster type of framework where NGOs to do with education, NGOs to do with rebuilding, NGOs to do with health, NGOs to do with water and sanitation, all worked in clusters. And we tried to engage, at least to have an open mind, but we found that they were just talks about talks, conferences about conferences, and very little action that was quick and necessary in such a situation. So we disengaged, to be honest. So we're very happy to be independent, yes.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Nazwa Ayu. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Najwa Ayub. I'm calling from Dubai. I work with Via Satellite Telecommunications. And my question is, we would like to work with MSF in terms of donating, helping during disasters or during Ebola, for example. And I can't find a way to reach out to MSF to give for free airtime and terminals to help them in their operations. Does MSF is open in any way to such activities, or who do we reach out to? Thank you.
Thank you, Najwa. You must be our neighbor somehow. I think in the UAE there is a very difficult, or not difficult, but there is a very strict climate in which we're allowed to do fundraising. It cannot be public without licensing and so forth. So it's a bit tricky, although we will be going to what is called the IHC, the International Humanitarian City, and at that time things will become much more open. But feel free to contact the office. If I don't know how you might be able to contact the office, and we will guide you along the way. But in general, along all the countries, wherever you are, there are MSF offices in 28 or 27 countries. And, you know, engaging with us, you can volunteer to do pro bono work. If you don't want to give money, you can, for example, help us with legal contracts, for example. There are many. If you are an advertiser. So there are many ways in which you can help us. I still think engaging, having awareness, talking about us to others, really spreading the word of the work we do itself is a huge work. And Nezwa, just for your own benefit, our website here in UAE is msf-me.org. You should just look on the website for contact details.
Great, and you will be in the IHC as well. You will be joining their team there, their offices?
Yes, we have every intention of being in IHC. We've applied for registration. It will come along as soon as it comes along. We're hoping it will only be a few months.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening.
Javed, I have a question regarding the differences between places that you go. I mean, I'm very much involved with the Syrian refugee issues, and like your views and how you contrast that, and that crisis and another crisis. Is there a common denominator? Do you feel there is more suffering on one side? How do you compare these different islands of connections?
It's a tricky one, that. You know, every context. Has incredible nuances, and I think it's a fantastic feature of MSF, and I'll give you examples shortly, where we get such proximity to the actors in the field creating or trying to alleviate the situation, the need for us to be there. So every context is super different, and of course the Syrian context is so ever so complicated. We will take the initial view of identifying the need. The need is a humanitarian work that we do. If there is a medical need, we will go there, regardless of what the context is, natural disaster, conflict, so on. However, then you need to ensure that we can deliver the care safely for our healthcare workers, safely for the patients in the facilities, and get our goods and supplies in and so forth. And that requires a lot of contextual analysis. We have people within each MSF office that do that. And it gets to a point where, and it's amazing, Basil, and everyone listening, I will give you my personal example of actually just in Haiti, for example, where we were working in a slum called Cité Soleil, City of Sun, a sun city, which in the early year 2000s was the official most dangerous place in the world, according to the UN. No entry for UN soldiers. Yet we can go in there wearing our MSF T-shirt. Why? Because firstly, the people living there recognize that we are doing good work for free healthcare for anybody who comes, but also because our field coordinators, our people who are in charge of the project, very much at the field level down there in the project, we're on the mobile phone to the gang leaders. So much so that if we hear a gunshot, we can call them and say, hey, who's shooting? Where are you? What's going on? So much so that when our convoy of our staff, we would only go in at 8 in the morning and leave at 4 in the afternoon, minimize movements to stop kidnapping or gunshot. We would call the gangs and say, guys, we're going to come through at this time. Give us a clear 30 minutes of no gunshots, please. And they would do it. So I think that proximity is something that I think very good at, and it's why we're always usually able to be right in there. Syria, Basil, though, has been very different. It's proven exceptionally difficult to get in. We have what should be our biggest response ever. So this, let's not beat around the bush. You know, the crisis in Syria is huge, internally displaced and refugees. What should be our biggest response ever is simply inadequate because we don't have the access, because the context is ever so difficult. The different factions ruling different territories. We found it simply too unsafe and too hard to be there in the capacity we want. So perhaps it is more special, as you say, there is more suffering perhaps there than anywhere else, because we haven't been able to get there. God knows, and other NGOs haven't been able to get there. And we're seeing the results now with refugees in the neighboring countries and the crisis in the Mediterranean and Europe. So it is exceptional.
Thank you so much, Javed. I mean, your platform and business model really gives me hope for the future. I think if we have more people doing what you're doing, contributing from their time and from their own self to alleviate some of the suffering, I think we're heading in the right direction.
I think so. We will keep trying. And thank you for lending me your ears. And feel free to talk about us to everybody that you meet.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you. I'd like to thank everyone who participated and connected in the call today for their attention and their interest. As I mentioned earlier, there will be a podcast of the call. It'll be available in about an hour. And there is also a webcast link, which will have the recording. For those of you that are part of the different communities in YPO, please visit the Thriving Communities in Peace Action and Global Diplomacy and Public Policy Network homepages for more information about their networks. And please connect with one another and also with your YPO champions if you're interested in moderating or championing one of these global conference calls. Or you have some interesting topic to suggest, because this has been a lot of fun for me personally. YPO is really about you know, leadership and getting what you want out of life. And I definitely feel that I've gotten a lot out of connecting with Javed and learning more about MSF and all of this topic that we discussed today. Thank you all very much. With
Thank
that, I hand it over to our operator to hang up.
Thank you. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Goodbye.